Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 241. And let's see, we're going to talk about respiratory system today. And it's Tuesday, November 24th, which means Thursday is Thanksgiving, which also means you don't have to come to class on Thursday because it is a holiday. All right? All right, I'm going to turn some of these lights down because we're going to get started with lecture, I believe. We are going to get started with lecture. Believe it or not. Okay, who's ready for lecture? Anybody ready for lecture? Oops, sorry. Okay, anybody have, it's fun to catch up with everybody, but if you got to catch up with somebody or discuss a question, go step out in the hall for just a little bit. Okay, so let's see. We said today is we're ahead of schedule, the 24th. Right? So we're going to start respiratory system. Don't believe we started that last time. And we got two lectures on that, one on renal physiology, one on diversification system. And then here's your last exam, Thursday, December 10th. Right? And that's going to be chapters 14, 16, 17, and 20. So that's the deal with that. And hopefully you have study guides for all of those things. The digestive system is completely online. So that's where you get course points for that and what to study for the digestive tract. All right, does anybody have a question over the schedule or what we talked about last time? Question about what we talked about last time? Good. Well, one thing that you should probably remember or know how to derive is that equation that says pressure is equal to cardiac output times stroke volume times resistance. And that resistance term is kind of weird. So you just got to memorize it or be able to figure out why that resistance term got into that particular equation. Because that's a really handy. Okay, you guys got to step out in the hall because I'm concerned that you're disturbing some folks around you. Okay? So please, don't disturb anybody around you, okay? Okay. All right. So respiratory system. Make sure you know everything that you learned from your anatomy class. And that will help you a lot. So we're going to start with some respiratory structures, and then we're going to go into gas transport, like oxygen and CO2, in a little bit. All right, so how did I get this going last time? Was it here or here? Reading view, slideshow view? Nope. That's not it. Because I don't have the arrow options. Go here. There. That works. Okay. We're ready. All right, so what is respiration? It's got a number of different terms. Some of these are quite different from each other. The first one is just a mechanical conception of respiration, and that is another way of thinking about that is ventilation, just moving air in and out of your lungs, or breathing. And we're going to see that there's two different kinds of breathing. There's forced breathing and quiet breathing. We'll talk about the mechanisms of both of those. And then another kind of respiration is gas exchange between blood and the tissues. So when blood is loaded up with oxygen, then blood releases that oxygen to tissues so that mitochondria have oxygen. And if mitochondria have oxygen, they undergo their cellular metabolism, and that cellular metabolism that requires oxygen is what we call internal respiration. That's just the biochemistry. Right? And the thing that drives all of this is that gas exchange is passive. Doesn't require any energy. It moves by diffusion. So if we have oxygen in the atmosphere and we need oxygen inside our cells, where is the concentration of oxygen going to be the lowest? If it's only by diffusion. And how does diffusion work? High to low. If oxygen is going to get inside your body, that's where oxygen concentration is the lowest. It's kind of a weird concept, but that's exactly how it works, right? And the same thing for CO2. CO2 moves by diffusion out of your body, so where is the concentration of CO2 the lowest? outside your body, right? So it's relatively high inside and relatively low on the outside. Otherwise, carbon dioxide would not diffuse either, right? And we want kind of low carbon dioxide levels in our body, but it's even lower in the atmosphere, thank goodness. It's almost zero. It's really, really low. So the concentration gradient is high, which means the rate of diffusion is high for CO2. All right, here we see some respiratory structures, right? Maybe starting with the nasal cavity, going into the pharynx, and then the larynx. These are all things I don't see on this slide. Then finally into the trachea. You get down here to the carina, then it bifurcates right and left lung. So the trachea becomes the primary or main bronchus, and this right primary bronchus looks a lot bigger than the left one over here. And who can tell me why that might be? Because the heart is over here, right? So it's taking up some space for the left lung. Left lung only has two lobes that I see. The right lung actually has three. And so the diameter of this primary bronchus is a lot larger because it needs to ventilate a bigger lung volume. Right? Clinically, maybe that has some significance because if somebody's choking, if they inadvertently let something fall into their trachea and it can go all the way down to the carina, it usually ends up on the right side, because it's a larger tube and it's more of a straight shot to get in there. Well, the one on the left is more of a 90 degree turn, so it's more difficult to get into the left lung. And that's sort of too bad, because if this primary bronchus on the right is occluded, that is going to the lung, which is the biggest, the most efficient, right? That's just unfortunate when that happens. All right, then when bronchi bifurcate again, then you get this secondary, tertiary, et cetera, these things all have cartilage. The larynx has cartilage, trachea has cartilage, bronchi have cartilage, but eventually it gets to some small tubes that we call bronchioles. And bronchioles do not contain any cartilage, just smooth muscle around them. And that smooth muscle has certain kinds of receptors in it, so that smooth muscle can relax, which dilates these bronchioles, or they can contract, with constricts those bronchioles. So what can you tell me about those muscles? How are they controlled? Tell me something about those receptors. I think that would be really nice to take away from the class. They're adrenergic receptors, right? And how many major kinds of adrenergic receptors are you familiar with? Alpha, beta, right? And in particular in the lung, they are the beta and the beta 2 receptors, nice. And so they are what, inhibitory or excitatory? Beta 2 are inhibitory, so that will cause that smooth muscle to relax, dilate the diameter of a bronchiole. And remember, when you change the radius of a tube, what happens to flow through it? It increases by what? The fourth power rule, right? So small changes in diameter allow for extremely large changes in flow. Whether it's blood or air, it really doesn't matter. All right, so these are bronchioles because I don't see any cartilage around them. And here is what we call a terminal bronchiole, which leads to what we call respiratory bronchioles, because on a respiratory bronchiole, there are these structures for gas exchange that we call an alveolus. So some bronchioles have these little areas right here for exchange. Right? And then the respiratory bronchiole leads to an alveolar sac, which contains many, many alveoli. And if we look at all the alveoli in our lungs, there's about 300 million alveoli in our lungs. So this is what we call the respiratory zone, because I see various alveoli located in different places. Okay, and so where exchange can take place, we call that the respiratory zone, as opposed to this place right here on the left-hand side where exchange doesn't take place, so that is just the conducting zone. And you know what? Every time we exhale, there's always some air that can't be expelled from our body in all of these bronchi, right, and the trachea and larynx. We're going to call that residual volume. So there's a lot of dead air space when we breathe. Okay, so an alveolus, one of these little sacs right here, if we look, do a cross-section of one, all right, I see a nice capillary. And what can you tell me about the endothelium of this capillary? I'll tell you what, I got another question for you. What's the function of a capillary? Exchange, and things happen usually by diffusion. So what should be the thickness of a capillary? It's got to be really thin, right? And maybe it even has holes in it. for, allows things to leak out. Remember, there's different kinds of capillaries. The ones in the lungs are continuous, right? These are the least leaky, but nonetheless, they are still very, very thin. And so what kind of epithelium lines a capillary? Can you tell me what an epithelium lines a cavity, covers the surface? How do we characterize an epithelium? By two major kinds of characteristics. The number of layers. And in this particular case, it's simple because there's only one layer. And then also by shape of the cells. And these are squamous. So that endothelium is a simple squamous epithelium, and that is specialized for exchange, and indeed that's what capillaries are made out of. So capillaries form a network around the alveolus, and I also see an alveolus over here, right? And if we look at the wall of the alveolus, it is also what kind of epithelium? Simple squamous, again, right? Just it's there because it facilitates diffusion. And then there's sometimes a very small interstitial space between the wall of the alveolus, the wall of the capillary, and these are the structures that oxygen and CO2 have to diffuse across to get from one place to another. And so sometimes we call the wall of the alveolus, the small interstitial space, and the wall of the capillary, the respiratory membrane. All right, respiratory membrane. And as you told me, it should be very, very thin to allow for gas exchange. All right, so the cells that make up the alveolus, these regular looking simple squamous cells, we call these alveolar type 1 cells. And there are other kinds of cells which we call alveolar type 2. Right, and oh, I see one right here. And it has a special function. It secretes a compound that's called surfactant into the alveolus, and we're going to see what the job of surfactant is when we get to it. All right, so if we take all of these alveoli, think of them as being an orange. One of them is an orange, and we can peel an orange, right, and take the skin of an orange and place it on the table right here. And then we can measure the surface area, right, because the surface area of this table you can measure, right, with a nice ruler. With a nice ruler. Is there one right? Ah, good, thank you. Okay, with a nice ruler, how would we measure the surface area of this table? You measure the width, okay, whatever it is, and then measure the length, kind of a dark ruler right there, and then you multiply the two numbers together to get what the surface area of this table is, right? Okay, well, there's another way that I think I would like you to know what surface area is. Let's look at the surface area of this door right here. This is a meter long. So what's the width of the door? It's about exactly 1 meter. And then to calculate surface area, what other measurement do we need to know? How tall it is, right? So let's see. It is 1 meter here. And then we've got to be really careful. Keep that mark right there. And I see, oh, it's exactly 2 meters. So that's really handy, right? That's really handy to measure that. So the surface area of that door is 1 times 2, or exactly 2 what? Square meters, that's the surface area. Okay, so let's increase the surface area of that door, and what happens to the function of that door? It's going to change, for sure, when we change the structure. We're going to make it bigger. How does it change? You can get more people through at one time, right? So right now, maybe we could get about 2 people through that door. Maybe they got a running start, maybe 3 people at the same time. But if we double the size of that door, like the 4 square meters, you can get a lot more than just 3 people through there, right? You can get 6, 7, or if you take that door and then think of a garage door, which is a lot bigger, maybe you can get 100 people through that door at one time. So how does exchange work, or how does exchange go with surface area? Directly related or inversely related? Directly related, right? If one goes up, so does the other. So the function of the lungs is for exchange of gases. So what would you expect for surface area, large or small? Should be really, really large. And let's figure out what that surface area is. All right, 300 million alveoli. And we're going to take each alveolus and make a flat surface out of it and put it on this table right here. And then the next alveolus we're going to get, put it right next. And then we're just going to lay all of those alveoli out on a table. And then what would be the surface area. It would be about 70 square meters. Right? Here's the range, about 70 square meters. Anybody have a sense of what 70 square meters is like? Yeah, it's a lot. I don't know if anybody plays tennis, but it's about half of a tennis court. Right? That's the surface area for exchange. So just think of that as being a doorway. You can get hundreds of people through that doorway at one time. So that's a huge surface area. And fortunately, evolution has figured out a way to take that large surface area, fold it up in the shape of these alveoli so that it fits into a small space, all that folding going on, right? Just like the surface of the brain. And I really like that idea because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as and tall as half of a tennis court, right? That would be pretty awkward finding clothes that size. So that surface area is built into the lungs by the shape of the alveolus. And when I say surface area, I want you to think of that everyday term, right, to understand some of the physiology. So if you think of surface area, how would I like for you to think about it? As a surface area is the same thing as a doorway. Yeah, think of it as a doorway. And as the doorway gets bigger, exchange is a lot faster. Okay. So that is pretty good. Respiratory membrane, a couple different kinds of cells, half the size of a tennis court. All right, so these alveoli are what we call polyhedral in shape. There are clusters at the end of the respiratory bronchioles, forms kind of like a honeycomb, and they call an alveolar sac. It's just a bunch of alveoli together. There are pores between the alveoli so that if one alveolus inflates with air, it can also move into a neighboring alveolus and inflate it. Okay, so we're going to look at conducting zone maybe for a slide. The trachea, probably you're all aware of, has a really nifty epithelium on it. Does anybody remember what the epithelium on the inside of the trachea was? Probably one of your favorite epithelia. Pseudo-stratified ciliated columnar epithelium. All right, so it's a ciliated epithelium. And what's the job of cilia? That's maybe the first or second week. Motility, right? And you could say sweeping. So all of these cilia are sweeping in the same direction. And what direction do you think that might be? They're sweeping up. That's right. Because if they were sweeping down, then dust particles would be swept down into your lungs, and that's a dead-end sac, right? And then your lungs would fill up with dust. But that doesn't happen because the cilia are sweeping up. There's also a goblet cells in that kind of epithelium. Goblet cells produce what kind of material? Mucus, right? And that helps protect the trachea, but it's also kind of sticky, so it traps particles. And then the cilia sweep that mucus with trapped dust particles and bacteria and other kinds of things up into the oral cavity, all right? And from the oral cavity, where does it go? Yeah, you just swallow it down, okay? Unless you're a baseball player, then you can spit it out to your heart's content, but not here. All right, so that's the conducting zone. What does it do? Well, just like the nasal cavity, it's an air conditioner system. So if you're breathing in air that is really dry, that could damage the lungs, then that mucous membrane humidifies the air. If the air we're breathing is hot, it cools the air down. If the air is cold, it warms the air up so we don't freeze the lungs, you know, within limits. So it's all a very good thing. But if you're breathing in really, really hot gases, it's still possible to burn the lungs because you can't get rid of all the heat in the trachea and bronchi. So good thing. Think of a filter, and it cleans inspired air. All right, y'all know the extent of the thoracic cavity. Right, and the inferior part of the thoracic cavity, there's a big strong muscle, skeletal muscle. So if it's skeletal muscle, what could you tell me about that muscle? It contracts. How does it contract? When does it contract? It's a little confusing because here's the biceps. And right now, it's not doing anything. Okay, it is voluntary. That's what I want you to know. So skeletal muscle is voluntary. I can contract that biceps and relax it. And the diaphragm is skeletal muscle as well. Okay, it will contract. You can hold your breath if you want to, right? Or you can breathe very rapidly if you want to because the diaphragm is skeletal muscle. If it was cardiac or smooth muscle, you would not be able to control the diaphragm. The reason why it's confusing is because When it contracts, it causes inspiration, and you don't have to think about every inspiration that you undergo. Right? So there is another center that helps automatically contract in a rhythmic way the diaphragm, but you can override those signals with your conscious thought because it is skeletal muscle. Like right now, we all could hold our breath, right? Hold it, until we pass out, as a matter of fact. And we wouldn't have to be too worried that we're all going to die, because as soon as we pass out, what's going to happen? Because of the rhythmicity centers in the medulla, you're going to automatically start breathing. Right? So there is an automatic control or influence on the diaphragm, but it's not autonomic. It's not parasympathetic or sympathetic. It's just some auxiliary way that the diaphragm can be stimulated. All right, so what else do we know about thoracic cavity? Well, it's got the heart, right, the mediastinum and lungs, all that kind of stuff. And we mentioned the abdominal pelvic cavity in this particular slide because sometimes it helps in ventilation. And the way that it helps is when we contract abdominal muscles, it compresses all of these organs right here, and it forces these organs superiorly up into the diaphragm, and it pushes the diaphragm into the thoracic cavity. So when all these organs get pushed up into the thoracic cavity, what happens to the volume of the thoracic cavity? The volume decreases, and that forces air out of the lungs. Right? So these things are important for expiration, but kind of in a secondary way. Okay, so nice cross-section of mediastinum and the lungs. And the lungs are in a cavity that are not open to the outside world. What kind of membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world? I tell you what, let's start with something a little bit more basic. And that is, what kind of membrane lines a cavity that's open to the outside world? Like oral cavity, reproductive cavity, okay, trachea, right, the respiratory tract, urinary tract, open to the outside world. Special kind of membrane called a mucous membrane. Mucus, it's just a layer of cells. Maybe it's a simple layer. Maybe it's really kind of complicated, like that pseudostratified ciliated columnar with goblet cells. And in that particular case, that membrane does secrete mucus, but mucous membranes don't always have to secrete mucus. The definition is they line a cavity open to the outside world. All right, so that's mucus. There are other cavities that are not open to the outside world, like the pericardial cavity, like the pleural cavity. And what kind of membrane lines these cavities? It's not mucus. It is a blast from the past. It is a serous membrane. Right? And a serous membrane is a little bit more complicated because it has three divisions to it, not just one. The division of that membrane that's right on the surface of the organ, and I can see it right here where I have the pointer, right? And as a matter of fact, maybe here's a little bit better place to see it. Right? That is what we call the visceral division of that serous membrane. And so this would be the visceral pleura, because the membrane or the cavity that surrounds the lungs is what the pleural cavity. Right? And so the membrane comes around to the edge over here, folds back on itself, and it goes back to where it came from. And we can't call this the visceral division because it's not touching the lungs. We call this the parietal division. And the reason why I went through all that is because this is the thing that we're really interested in, and that is there is something between the visceral pleura and the parietal pleura, and that is the pleural space, right? The pleural space. So we're going to be the pleural space or pleural cavity. We're going to be interested in knowing some physical chemistry of that particular space. And in that space, in the intrapleural space, this right here has a pressure. And we're going to call that the intrapleural pressure, right? The pressure in the space over here. We're going to be interested in pressure inside the lungs. That can't be the intrapleural pressure. That is what we call the intrapulmonary pressure. So intrapulmonary inside the lungs, intrapleural in the serous space, and then we have pressure on the outside of your body. We just call that atmospheric pressure. All right, so we have these spaces that we're going to be really interested in. So let's use some of that anatomy to understand ventilation. And remember, ventilation is just moving air in and out of our lungs. And we know something about how air flows. Air is a fluid. How is fluid going to move? Kind of like diffusion. from high something to low something. Pressure, just like blood. Okay, so air is going to move from one spot to another based on pressure. It's always going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. A difference in pressure. Now I grabbed this for some reason. Okay. Ah. Okay. There's a nice relationship between pressure and volume that I want you to be familiar with. So the pressure of something is going to be related to volume, and it's maybe not really obvious, but maybe it is. Okay, take a balloon that has a certain volume, squeeze it so that the volume goes down. What happens to the pressure? It increases. What kind of relationship is that? Inversely related. Yeah, something changes in different ways. So we're going to have 1 over volume. If volume increases, pressure goes down. Volume decreases, right? We're not dividing by such a big number. The pressure goes up. All right, and the way that we ventilate is by changing the volume of the thoracic cavity, which produces changes in pressure, and that's what moves air in and out of our lungs. It just so happens that our lungs have some really nifty properties. They're highly compliant, which means that with small changes in pressure, they can expand a lot. Right, and one way to think of something that's compliant is compare a balloon that you have with your car tire. One is a lot more compliant than the other. Can anybody tell me which one is more compliant? Car tire or balloon? Small changes in pressure cause big changes in volume. And that is going to be the balloon, right? Because you can blow air into the balloon, that's a small change in pressure, and if you try to blow air in the tire, what's going to happen? Nothing. More air is going to come out than go in, right? So because a tire is not compliant, doesn't change volume with small changes in pressure. Lungs are also very elastic, so that when a lung tissue or an alveolus is stretched or expanded, when you release that tension, guess what happens to the alveolus? It goes back to its original shape, right? Because of those elastic proteins. And there's surface tension in the lungs. All of these things influence ventilation. All right, so here is an introduction to some of these pressures once again. So where is this intrapulmonary pressure at? Intrapulmonary. Inside the lungs. That's really nice. Okay. And intrapleural pressure is in this serous space, right? The pleural cavity. That's another way of saying that. All right, so usually the surface of the lung adheres to the thoracic wall, so that when there are changes in the volume of the thorax, the lung gets pulled along with it. So in this space, there's a sticky substance, which is water. Do you consider water sticky at all, or slippery? Slippery or sticky? Slippery. A lot of people like to say sticky. I mean slippery, right? Because if there's water on the floor, you can slip by it. Right, but I want you to appreciate that water is actually very sticky. It's like a glue, right? And that glue then helps glue the wall of the lung, right, this exterior part of the lung, to the thoracic wall. So they're tightly coupled together. And what is that property that makes water sticky? It is called surface tension. And remember, if you take 2 water molecules, right, they will like to stick together because they're both polar, but because they're polar, right, there is an attraction between them, right? The oxygen is negative, the hydrogen is positive, and opposite charges do what? They attract each other, so those water molecules are attracted to each other, and they can actually act like glue. So, I got a couple transparencies right here, and there's no water on them. I got 2, and if I put them together really nice, and I just hold on to one, what's going to happen to the other one? It should just fall down, right? Oops, I let go of both of them. Okay, let go of one. Ah, like that, right? They just fall apart. But if we want to glue these things together, what do we need? We need glue. Where can we find glue? Ah, we have some water right here, right? You don't believe that water is a glue yet. Okay, well, it is. Let's see if I can get some water out of here without... How are you in the first row? Did I get any on you? No? Okay, good. Good, good, good. Okay, then we're going to put these transparencies together, like so. All right, and I'm just going to make sure that there's really nice, good contact on them, and then we get water all over the place. All right, but it's for science, so that's probably okay. All right, So now I put some water. I got some water in there. Some of it came off already. Let me redo that a little bit. I only had water on like half of it. More water. Great. Okay, and then I want to overlap it so I can just grab one easily, like this. Okay, make sure they're really touching each other, not just floating on each other. All right, so if I take these transparencies and I hold on to one, okay, and let go of the other one, what's going to happen to the other one? Yeah, so you guys know that. They're going to stick together, right? So they're really, really nicely stuck together. As a matter of fact, okay, I'm going to come over here. I'm going to hold one, and then you pull on the bottom one. Whoa, that's really sticky, right? You believe? I should give you a paper towel. Did I get any water on you? Okay. So, yeah, so these things are really stuck together because of surface tension, because water molecules are both polar, right, and they stick together. We can separate these things if we pull them apart really easily, just like that. All right, so that surface tension, that glues the wall of the lungs to the wall of the thorax. Or you could say the visceral pleura is attached to the parietal pleura because water is acting like a glue. So that when the volume of the thorax changes, that also pulls the lung along with it. Okay. Yeah, so here it says, water is really sticky. I like that. All right, so how does inspiration and expiration really work? Well, we're going to talk about intrapulmonary and intrapleural pressures. Right? During inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure is about -3 millimeters of mercury, and what that means is that is lower than atmospheric pressure by 3 millimeters of mercury. So that 760 millimeters of mercury atmospheric pressure is just going to be used like a baseline number to measure some smaller changes that happen in these different kinds of cavities. All right, so inspiration, intrapulmonary pressure is about -3. During expiration, it's about +3. Right, and so if the pressure, and what is intrapulmonary once again? Inside the lungs, right? So if the pressure is below atmospheric pressure, then air will want to flow in. Yeah, it will want to flow in. During expiration, it's about 3 millimeters of mercury above atmospheric pressure, so air is going to flow out the other way. Okay. The other thing, that another pressure right here that I don't have a diagram of, but we'll just kind of draw it on the board, is what we call the transpulmonary pressure, or, right? Sometimes transmural pressure, either one of those. So what do we got right here? We have a nice thoracic cavity. Is that dark enough for you guys to see in the back so far? Yeah, so good. And so this is a like a transverse section, no, coronal section. Oh, bad diagram. Coronal section of somebody, and here we have a lung over here, little cardiac notch. Here we have a nice lung on this side. So, and then we have the wall of the thorax, like so. So this is that serous fluid, the pleural cavity. So the pressure inside this pleural cavity is called what? The intrapleural pressure. And the pressure inside the lungs, like this, is intrapulmonary. And the construct that we're going to use in our mind is, what's the difference of these two pressures? And that's what we call the transmural. That means across the wall of the lungs. All right, so that's going to be one minus the other. And how do we want to define that? Transpulmonary pressure, transmural pressure, that's the same thing. Transpulmonary pressure, okay, is going to be equal to the intrapulmonary minus the intrapleural. Now, what does that mean? The transpulmonary pressure is the pressure inside the lungs minus the pressure in this space right here. That's the transmural pressure. And we're going to measure these pressures. Right? So here on this table, we see that the intrapulmonary pressure, all right, where is that? That's inside the lungs.
I'm going to turn the lights off, I think, right now, or most of them. Yeah, probably like that. Okay, intrapulmonary pressure on inspiration, all we just said was -3, and then on expiration is +3. Now, what you don't know is the intrapleural pressure. Look at this intrapleural pressure, and that's in what? The pleural space. It's -6 on inspiration and -3 on expiration. It never goes positive, right? And we want to look at the transpulmonary or transmural pressure. They're exactly the same thing. We're going to subtract these things from each other. So 3 minus 6 is 3, okay? And then even on expiration, it's 3 minus 3 of a minus 3 is +6. So what does that mean? That there is always, where is high pressure always occurring? Okay, that transmural pressure, okay, which always says that pressure is high inside the lungs and low in the transpulmonary, in the transpleural space. And so which way will air have a tendency to move? From high to low, and so it's going to always inflate the lungs, right? So that transmural pressure is always going to have that natural ability to keep the lungs inflated and touching the thoracic wall. So that transmural pressure plus the stickiness of water attaches the surface of the lung to the thorax. Both of those things work in that direction. Okay, so the transmural pressure from here to here is always positive, so it's always pushing the lungs out, so they stay attached to the wall of the thorax. That's real handy, because the only way that we can change, get air in and out of our lungs is by changing the volume of the thorax. All right, Boyle's Law. We talked about this already, right? This says that the intrapulmonary pressure occurs because of a change in volume, right? And Boyle's Law just shows you the, what kind of relationship between pressure and volume? Inverse relationship. That's right, so an increase in lung volume does what to pressure? Decreases it, right? When a decrease in volume increases pressure, and that volume then can be used to manipulate whether you're inspiring or expiring, inhaling or exhaling. So when there's a decrease in lung volume, right, then that causes expiration because that increases intrapulmonary pressure. When lung volume increases, that causes inspiration because that causes a decrease in intrapulmonary pressure. All right, that's just Boyle's Law. All right, compliance. I think we talked about that. Compliance is just a measure of how easily something can expand when there are small changes in volume. The lungs are highly compliant so that they can inflate very easily when there is a small change in pressure, like maybe 3 millimeters of mercury. There are some pathological conditions that can reduce that compliance, and then somebody's going to be in respiratory distress when that happens. The lungs are also highly elastic, which means that once they inflate, they can shrink back down to their normal size very easily because those elastic fibers are stretched, and then it's going to bring all those alveoli back down to their normal size. Okay. All right, surface tension. Talked about surface tension already. It acts like what? A glue. All right, and do I have a picture? Oh, here I have a nice alveolus right here. So here is, looks like an alveolar sac. Let's pretend that these are, it's just an alveolus. And there is a law of Laplace, which you don't have to be too familiar with in this class, but it just says that the pressure inside an alveolus, or this space over here, is going to be higher in a small alveolus compared to a large one by radius. All right? And that is if the surface tension is the same. So in this particular case, if we inspire air, some might go into this small alveolus, some maybe gets into this larger one over here, right? But what's going to happen? All of the air, even in the smaller alveolus, is going to be shifted to this one, and what's going to happen to this, the size of the one on the left? It's going to get bigger. And when it gets bigger, that's going to force it to get bigger still, bigger and bigger and bigger. Right, and that destroys that respiratory membrane. It destroys the surface area for exchange because instead of having 300 million small ones with a large surface area, like we said, half of a tennis court, right, you're just going to have a few alveoli that are huge, and the surface area is diminished drastically when that happens. Right. And so this happens when there's surface tension. So there is a way to get rid of that surface tension, and that is the alveolar type 2 cells secrete something that's very much like a phospholipid, and that's called surfactant, and that disrupts the surface tension. Basically, it erases that surface tension. So when surfactant is in the lungs, when we change the volume of the thoracic cavity, all the alveoli experience the same pressure, and they experience the same inflation drive, right? So all of these alveoli go to the proper shape. There isn't one or two that just get really big and suck all the air out of the other ones. Right. Might be important. So here is the wall of that alveolus. That's a type 1 cell. Right. Here's a type 2 that secretes surfactant, and that just prevents the collapse of alveoli. Because there is secretion into the alveolus, the water is inside the alveolus, and if the opposite walls of an alveolus would touch each other without surfactant, they would get what? Like these two transparencies. They get glued together, right? And then you wouldn't be able to get any air inside of that alveolus. But when there is surfactant, that prevents them, the opposite walls of an alveolus, to stick together. And it allows them to inflate. Right, and that's from an alveolar type 2 cell. Let me see what's on the next slide. Okay. Okay, those type 2 cells that we were looking at right here develop pretty late in pregnancy, in late term, and they're actually stimulated into secreting surfactant into the lung by stress. When the infant or the fetus experiences stress, like being born is very stressful. That's when these cells get activated so that when somebody is born normally, there's a lot of surfactant in the lungs, which then means that a newborn baby has a relatively easy job inflating these alveoli. Right? If there's a premature baby and these type 2 cells are not mature, they don't secrete surfactant, and that little baby has a very hard time breathing because the alveoli are all stuck together. Right? And so we just call that respiratory distress syndrome. Right, or RDS, and what normally do we do for infants in that particular case, premature babies, or maybe, and of course they're always cesarean section, then they're just placed in an incubator, right, which is higher temperature because they have trouble regulating temperature, but also in that incubator is a high concentration of oxygen, but more than atmospheric pressure of oxygen. So if the partial pressure or the pressure of oxygen in an incubator is greater, and it's low in the infant, where is it going to go? It's going to diffuse in. It's going to have a better capacity to diffuse in. It does cause some problems, right? It can cause blindness if it's not done properly. And who knows why it might cause blindness. You have to think. You have to think about the structure, the layers of the eye. Okay. Yeah, what about that? What kind of cells does a retina have? It has photoreceptor cells, like rods and cones, that allows for vision. And what layer has blood vessels? Does the retina have blood vessels? Indeed, it does not, because it has photoreceptor cells, right? What layer has blood vessels? It is the choroid in particular, the layer right below the retina. So that if an infant is placed in an atmosphere high in oxygen, oxygen diffuses through the cornea, past the lens, into that posterior segment of the eye, right into the retina, and that high oxygen in the retina then stimulates blood vessels from the choroid to grow not only in the choroid, but also up into the retina. And when blood vessels grow into the retina, that produces blind spots, right? And so that's just called retinopathy of prematurity. So anything that destroys the retina, we call that a retinopathy. Adults can experience a decrease in surfactant secretion when they have systemic shock or septic shock, and that's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, a little bit different than RDS. All right, so surfactant is really important. Mechanics of breathing. Well, we looked at Boyle's law, right? Which relates volume to pressure.
And we have a couple plain films right here looking at some lungs. So there's not a lot of tissue in lungs, so there's not much signal. And the top case is when somebody is at rest with normal lung volume. And here we have the same individual, same film, right, same dimensions. And here we can see that the lung volume is what compared to what it is initially, and the dotted line represents what it was initially. Right, so we just took this top slide, put it over the other, and traced it over, so that's really easy to do. So what happens in this second case where the lungs are expanded like this? The volume of the thorax has increased. And if the volume increases, what happens to pressure? It has decreased. And if it's decreased, what happens to airflow? It flows in the lungs, right? So in this particular case, the lungs are deflated. Maybe air is moving out, but certainly it is not moving in. In the second condition over here, the volume has increased, which means pressure decreased, so air is going to flow into the lungs as a result of that. All right, so what changes the size of the thorax? Well, what do we use? What kind of muscles do we use to move our skeleton around? Skeletal muscles, right? So you're familiar with a whole bunch of skeletal muscles. And maybe the first most important one, and did I see it on that plain film? Let's go back. Sort of. Okay. There's a muscle right here that separates thoracic from abdominal cavity, and you know the name of that muscle. That is the diaphragm, and it's skeletal muscles, and so I can see it right here. That's under voluntary control. Oh, look how big dome-shaped it is. It goes all the way up over to here, then down over to here. So that's the diaphragm. I see a number of other muscles attached to ribs. Right, so not only is the size of the thoracic cavity adjusted from superior to inferior by contracting the diaphragm, but also laterally, because these muscles over here can pull the rib cage outward and up. Right, so the thoracic cavity changes size quite a bit. And there are two kinds of breathing. There's quiet breathing, and on the next slide there is deep breathing, or forced breathing. Quiet breathing and forced breathing, the same kind of concept. On one side of this illustration, we see muscles of inspiration, and on the right side, we see muscles of expiration. Okay, so let's take a look at some of these. The most important muscle for inspiration, right, is the diaphragm. When it contracts, it gets a lot shorter, like any other muscle. So if you have this big curved line, and you make that line shorter, what's going to happen to it? It's going to, and you keep the endpoints the same, then it's going to flatten out. So that when the diaphragm contracts, it moves inferiorly like that, the volume of the thorax increases when that happens. That's the most important muscle. For expiration, okay, for quiet breathing, there are no muscles that are required. It's completely passive, right? The diaphragm is relaxed, and because of elasticity, it goes back up to its normal location, and that decreases the volume of the thorax. What happens to pressure inside the lungs when the diaphragm goes back to this big dome structure? Pressure goes up, right? And we exhale as a result of that. So the strange thing is that for quiet breathing, it requires some muscle. That's an active process, right? Because muscles need ATP. But for expiration, like what you are doing right now, quiet breathing, it doesn't require contraction of any muscles. All right, and that's because of elasticity of the diaphragm. But what else has elastic fibers around them? Every single alveolus does. Right. So for quiet breathing, when we don't have to ventilate quickly, those elastic properties then just forces smaller volume, and that moves air in and out of, moves air out of our lungs. All right, so expiration right here, they say, is due to passive recoil. All right, that's kind of nice. But the most important thing is what? Passive. No energy is required. Just relaxation of the diaphragm, and you can exhale. All right, for forced breathing, there are some other muscles because we want to move the size of the thorax faster. All right, so for inspiration, then we got the sternocleidomastoid scalenes, right? And these are attached to the first two ribs. And you can't really pull the first two ribs up, but maybe it pulls them up a little bit, but it stabilizes them so that they can't be pulled down when other muscles contract. Right? And so the muscles, some auxiliary muscles for inspiration are the external intercostals that we see right here. Probably you learned that in anatomy. external intercostals for inspiration. There are some parasternal. Para just means on what, either side of the sternum. When these muscles contract, right, it pulls the ribs superiorly, and it pulls this outer margin laterally, increasing the volume of the thorax. So these are muscles that help inspiration. And when you're breathing quickly or forced breathing, deep breathing, we need more than just the diaphragm to relax, to get air out of our lungs. And then there are internal intercostals, which pull the rib cage back down, right, decreasing the volume of the thorax, and that helps expel air. And then, of course, in the abdominal region, there are abdominal muscles, all of the abdominal muscles, the rectus, the transverse, internal, external, oblique. When they contract, it pushes all of these abdominal organs, right? It compresses those abdominal organs up into the diaphragm, and again, that helps decrease the volume of the thorax. Right, so those are some extra muscles that are necessary for deep breathing. What's strange about quiet breathing? What is something really strange about quiet breathing? It is what? Inspiration is active, expiration is passive. And so since it's passive, what property is being used to expel air from our lungs passively? The elasticity, right? Elasticity. Elastic fibers around every alveolus, and elasticity even of the diaphragm. All right, the next couple slides are good to look at. Atmospheric pressure is always going to be 760 millimeters of mercury. I'll look on this slide right here. It says 769. Does anybody have a slide with 769 on it? If you do, it's okay with me if you just crumple up that piece of paper and throw it away, right? Because it's never that. So if you have 769, it should be what number? 760, right? So 760. And I kind of see some 760s around. All right, so here, the diaphragm is a nice dome shape. And here is the intrapulmonary space, right? Inside the lungs, that's the intrapulmonary pressure. Here is the pleural space with the intrapleural pressure. And let's compare the intrapulmonary pressure with atmospheric pressure. So at rest, the intrapulmonary pressure inside the lungs is 760. And what is atmospheric pressure? 760. So which way is air going to move, in or out? Which is higher, 760 or 760? They're exactly the same, right? So air is not going to move one way or the other. All right, so that's kind of interesting, but let's look at the last piece of information here. Look at this intrapleural pressure. What is it? Is it above or below 760? It is always going to be below the intrapulmonary pressure, which does what? It helps inflate the lungs, which helps attach it to the wall of the thorax. All right, that's what that transmural pressure is really helpful for. So how do we get air inside the lungs? Well, we contract the diaphragm, so that the diaphragm moves inferiorly, and maybe some other muscles that pull the ribcage out laterally and superiorly, increasing the volume of the thoracic cavity. And when the volume increases, what happens to pressure? Because of Boyle's law, pressure goes down. All right, so on inspiration, atmospheric pressure is still the same, right, 760. What happens to the intrapulmonary pressure? It goes down. And we already said it goes down by 3 millimeters of mercury, and you can see that, right? 760 minus 757, it goes down. All right, so where is low pressure in this B figure? Where's low pressure? Intrapulmonary or atmospheric pressure? Lower is intrapulmonary, and so air flows into our lungs because of that, right? Because of that pressure difference. And look, the intrapleural pressure is always less than the intrapulmonary, and so that's going to help inflate the lungs when that happens. All right, so what is happening during expiration? The volume changes, the volume decreases, right, depending on what kind of breathing you're doing, forced breathing or quiet breathing, right, but nonetheless, the volume of the thorax decreases. Then what happens to the pressure if volume decreases? It increases because of Boyle's law. So now if we look, we see that the intrapulmonary pressure is 763. That's a real number, right? And what's atmospheric pressure? 760, less than that. So air will go from high pressure to low pressure as a result. But what about the inflation of the lungs? Let's look at that transmural pressure. which is what? Transpulmonary minus trans plural. No, yeah, trans plural, right? And so we see that 760 is a lot greater than 757. So the lungs are always pushing into that space as a result, keeping the lungs inflated, even though you're expiring. That's really handy to do. Let's look at this particular case right here on inspiration. And that's done because the volume of the thorax has increased, decreasing the pressure, right? 757. And the pressure in the intrapleural space is 754. And is that above or below atmospheric pressure? That is below atmospheric pressure. So if there's a perforation of the thoracic cavity into the pleural cavity, right, then since the pleural cavity has lower pressure, what happens to air? It flows inside, right, goes through that hole into this intrapleural space, and it becomes 760. And when it's atmospheric in this intrapleural space and it's 757 in the intrapulmonary space, what happens to the lungs? They collapse when that happens. That's called a pneumothorax, right? When the chest wall is perforated, then the lungs collapse, and then somebody's really unhappy. They're really uncomfortable because they can't breathe. Right. Okay, and the same situation over here. Look at that intrapulmonary pressure. Even on expiration, it's lower than atmospheric pressure. So even on expiration, air is going to flow into this pleural cavity, and it's going to then not allow the lungs to adhere to the thoracic wall. All right, so pneumothorax is pretty dangerous. Some people experience pneumothorax spontaneously, others by traumatic injury. Okay, anybody got a question about this? Do you have a good sense why the lungs are always inflated, no matter what the volume of the thorax is? Right? It's just due to those pressure changes. So we want to know about the volumes inside the lung and how they change with breathing. And an instrument that we use to measure those volumes is called a spirometer. And so that study of assessing volumes of lungs using a spirometer is called spirometry. Right, so spirometry is a method where you measure volumes that is moved in and out of the lungs on inspiration and expiration. And remember, I mentioned that anatomic dead space. So there's air always going to be in the trachea because what can you tell me about a trachea? Does it collapse or does it always remain open? It's open because of those tracheal cartilages. And that's the reason why they're there. Because when we pressurize our thoracic cavity to get air out of our lungs, right, if the trachea could collapse, it would. And if the trachea collapses, then what happens to air leaving your lungs? Can't get out, right? So without that cartilage, you won't be able to exhale. So the trachea is held open all the time, no matter what the pressure is inside the thorax, so that air can move in and out. But of course, that has some consequences, because if the trachea is held open all the time, do I have a picture of a trachea someplace? Close your eyes. Oh, there's good enough. Okay. All right, so the trachea is held open all the time. That's really good for breathing. But it's a problem when what happens? If you'd have a piece of food, instead of going down the esophagus, it ends up over here in the larynx. It's going to fall right into the trachea, right? And it could occlude the trachea, or if it's smaller, maybe it's going to go into a primary bronchus and occlude that bronchus. What do we call that abnormal, pathological condition? That is choking, right? When you can't inflate your lungs because there's something in there. And that's just because of the structure of the trachea. Hopefully it's not too serious a condition if somebody knows how to clear that airway. Does anybody know how to clear that airway in here? What's that procedure? Yeah, the Heimlich maneuver, okay? So you just dramatically step behind somebody, make a fist in their abdominal region, and push in and up. That drastically decreases the volume inside their thorax, and so what happens to the pressure? It skyrockets, and hopefully it kind of just shoots that particle right out of their mouth. So don't point somebody at me when you do that. Okay. All right, that's because the trachea is held open all the time. This is what the spirometer gives us. This is just information. And remember, we've always got to look at the axes. So here is volume, right, versus various kinds of procedures like breathing, changing the size of the thorax, changing pressures, inside the thoracic cavity. Right, so the normal lung volume is, so here is the maximum volume inside a lung. So a typical person, it's almost 6,000 milliliters, right, or 6 liters. That's pretty much the maximum air that a typical lung can inhale. Right, and look at this down over here. I see some little waves. Right, this is what we call tidal volume. Tidal volume is just the normal amount of air that we move in and out of our lungs when we're doing quiet breathing. And, okay, what is that? It's maybe about 500 mLs, 500, a very small amount of air, right? And notice where it's located. Is it located near the top of the total volume or the bottom of the total volume or the middle? It's right smack in the middle, right? So the lungs can get a lot bigger and they can get a lot smaller. This tidal volume is positioned right smack in the middle. So, since there is a lot of space, a lot of lung volume above tidal volume, we call that the inspiratory reserve. So if we have to switch from quiet to forced breathing because we're exercising, our lung can accommodate that, right? We can get a lot more oxygen inside our thoracic cavity, and that just helps absorption of oxygen. We call that the inspiratory reserve volume, right? So at the end of a normal inspiration, like this, and then you inhale as much as you can, like this, I'm using my inspiratory reserve volume, right? It's on top of tidal volume. There is also this expiratory reserve volume. At the end of a normal expiration, what can you do? You can even force more air out of your lungs. And of course, in order for that to happen, right, either one of these, you have to have a normal lung, right? And fortunately, I have more or less normal lungs. All right, so you have that expiratory reserve volume. And if we add inspiratory reserve volume together with tidal volume, together with expiratory reserve volume, that is what? The actual amount of air that you can move in and out of your lungs. And that right there is what we call a capacity, because we're adding various volumes together. That's what we call vital capacity. Vital capacity is really, really important. You might have noticed already that there is some air right here, almost 1,500 mLs, that we can't expel from our respiratory tract, right? And that's because the trachea is not compliant, right? There's always air spaces that we can't get air out of. We call that residual volume. So those are the ones that I really want you to know. Well, total lung capacity is good for you to know, right? Tidal volume, expiratory reserve, inspiratory reserve, residual. And then if we add inspiratory, expiratory, and tidal volume together, we get something called vital capacity. I don't think you have any online questions talking about functional residual capacity or inspiratory capacity, all right, but at least the ones that I mentioned. Tidal, inspiratory reserve, expiratory reserve, residual, and vital capacity. Okay, when there is pulmonary disease, this residual volume has a tendency to increase, all right, and it increases. So if it increases, what happens to tidal volume? It can stay the same, okay? But if it stays the same, what happens to the reserve volumes? They decrease, right? So during forced breathing, somebody with expanded residual volume cannot change their activity because they can't ventilate properly to match whatever work that they're doing. And if residual volume increases even some more, okay, maybe up to this level right here, then the only volume you have is tidal volume. Right? You don't have any reserve capacity whatsoever under certain circumstances of severe disease. And if it's even greater than that, okay, your tidal volume is like this, then what happens? Okay, because you have this big dead airspace in your lungs that's not ventilating, not allowing oxygen to enter your body. Well, there's various things you can do. People walk around with oxygen bottles, right? Or if it's really bad, a lung transplant. And one of the most dangerous things you can do to your lungs is smoke. So don't smoke anything. I don't care what it is. Because those elastic tissues get damaged, then that airspace increases, which means the residual volume increases, which means your vital capacity decreases. Those are all terrible things. And that happens normally with age anyway. There's no reason why you should accelerate that process. All right, so that is an exam figure. Since it's an exam figure, probably do have to know how to label inspiratory capacity,
right? Functional residual capacity, but you don't have to work with any of those volumes in a physiologic sense. Okay, anybody got a question about that? Just remember, air is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, when do we stop in here? 45? Okay, good. I was wondering if it was 12:15. It's not 12:15. Good. All right, let's talk about, since the job of the lungs is gas exchange, so we know there's capillaries in there, we want to look at some factors that affect gas exchange. And in order to understand that, we want to know how a gas is put together, because we can't talk about concentrations like we can in a solution. So we talk about the components of a mixture of gases in terms of the pressures that each one of those components applies to that particular volume. All right, so atmospheric pressure we know to be 760 millimeters of mercury, but we know that there are a number of gases in air like oxygen, there's a little bit of CO2, there's a lot of nitrogen gas, and there's even some water vapor, right? Not water liquid, but once it turns into a vapor, that's a gas, and there's a partial pressure for water. And if we add up all of these pressures together, we get 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay, so and that's just basically Dalton's law that says that the total pressure is equal to all the sum of all of the partial pressures in that particular mixture of gases. You could think of partial pressure as concentration if you wanted to. That's not a bad way of thinking about it. So all of these components are going to move from one area to another based on not a concentration gradient, but a pressure gradient, right? But it's still the same way, from high to low. Okay. If we look at just inspired air compared to air that is in this alveolus, right? Depending on the humidity of the air, the partial pressure of oxygen can change, right? And probably in Southern California it doesn't change too much. It's the humidity here is very, very low, so the partial pressure for water in inspired air is very, very low. Here's carbon dioxide, 0.3 millimeters of mercury. Hardly any carbon dioxide in the air around us. Oxygen, 159. What is the major component of air that we're breathing? It is nitrogen gas with over 600 millimeters of mercury. If we want to find out what the atmospheric pressure is, we just add these numbers together, and I never have done that, but hopefully it's really close to 760. Otherwise, there's a mistake someplace. All right, when we inhale air, what happens to the humidity? Well, you have the trachea, right, nasal cavity, humidifies the air, so the partial pressure of water goes up to about 50. Okay, inside this alveolus, right, there's carbon dioxide diffusing out of our body into the alveolus, so now there is a significant contribution to carbon dioxide, now at 40. Oxygen concentration goes down because it's being absorbed into your body, and nitrogen should stay pretty close to the same, but I see it's changed a little bit, probably because water increases. All right, and that still has to equal 760 millimeters of mercury. All right, so here we are to these alveolar sacs once again, and each alveolus. This slide is pretty nice because it shows the capillary network around each alveolus. There is another network of fibers around every alveolus besides this capillary. And it's not shown on this diagram, but it's pretty important. We talked about it already. What kind of fibers surround every alveolus? Those elastic fibers, right? So that when an alveolus expands on inspiration, if you relax that diaphragm, those elastic fibers then cause the shrinkage of that alveolus once again. All right, and these things right here, are these bronchioles or are these bronchi? And how would you know? Bronchi or bronchioles? Okay, it's labeled bronchiole, so that's really nice. Why bronchiole? Because I don't see any cartilage, right? I just see smooth muscles, right, with those beta 2 receptors, which can cause relaxation of these muscles, increases the radius of this tube right here, makes it a lot easier to ventilate. When these things go into spasm, right, when these things contract, guess what happens to the radius of this bronchiole? Decreases. What happens to flow through that bronchiole? Decreases a little bit or a lot? A lot, because of the fourth power rule, right? That's Poiseuille's equation, okay.
All right, so when there's spasm here, like during an asthma attack, people have a really difficult time breathing. All right, we talked about the surface area. There's a huge surface area. What's the surface area if we were to add it up for all of these alveoli? Half of a tennis court, right? That's a huge, huge doorway. What else do I want to say about this particular slide? Ah, surfactant. Oh, alveolus. The elastic properties of an alveolus. Okay, I think I have another quick demonstration right here. I have a couple containers right here on the desktop. And here is one. Here's a container. Last night I had something else in there, but today it's just kind of like that. All right, this is just a nice paper bag. And then here is another container. And it's not full of anything either. And I maybe used a lot of those last night too. All right, so this pretend this is an alveolus and this is an alveolus, and I want you to tell me which one really acts more like an alveolus. Which one has a better property to it? Okay. So maybe the balloon, maybe the paper bag. So what we want to do is inflate both of them. Let's put some air. Let's inspire some air into these alveoli. So here's a nice paper bag. Make a nice respiratory bronchiole. And I'm going to inflate it. Okay, and I'm going to grab it, close it like that, so the air is trapped inside the bag. All right, so we got air in there. And now I'm going to open up the airway. What's going to happen to the air inside this paper bag? Like that, and I'm going to let go and put it right here. What happened to the air in that alveolus? It's there. It's just stuck. Can't get out. All right, if that's a real alveolus, if air can't get out, what about inspiration? There's new air. There's no new air that can go in, right? So that's bad. What about this kind of alveolus right here? We put some air in. Ah, that's a nice alveolus, okay, because it inflated really nice. Oh, sorry. And now if I open up this airway right here, what happens to the air inside the balloon? It's going to go out, right, because of the elastic properties of the balloon, and indeed it did, right, with a lot of force. So, which model alveolus is more like real life? The paper bag or the balloon? For sure the balloon, right, because of all those elastic fibers. All right, so don't forget about those elastic fibers. It provides for what we call the passive recoil of the alveoli, which helps in expiration. Helps in expiration. Okay, pulmonary circulation. Well, let's talk about the heart for a second. How many chambers does the heart have? I know I heard two, but I don't like that as an answer very well. Okay, how many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves does the heart have? All this stuff you should just automatically know. Four valves, right? You should know all the valves. How many sides does the heart have? It's got two sides. And what are the sides called? Right side, left side. Okay. And so the heart has two sides. How many major circulations are there in the body? There are two. Could anybody name what they are? Pulmonary and systemic circulation. That's right. So here we are at pulmonary circulation. That's one of the major circulations. Pulmonary means to the lungs, right? So from the right ventricle up to the lungs and then back down to the left atrium, that's the pulmonary circulation. And that's a relatively short distance for blood to travel. What about the systemic circulation? It's very long, right? So the left ventricle pumps blood through everywhere else in your body. So which one has more resistance to it, the pulmonary or systemic? Resistance is directly related to the length of a tube, right? So the longer the tube, more resistance. So the systemic circulation has a lot more resistance, and the pulmonary circulation has a lot less because it's a shorter tube. Right, and so that's important because the right side of the heart has to pump, in terms of flow, the cardiac output of the right side of the heart has to equal the left side. Right, the right and left have to be pumping the same amount of blood, otherwise blood is going to back up someplace. Right, and that doesn't happen. So if the resistance in one pathway is higher than the other, what you need to have the same flow? Blood flow is equal to pressure divided by resistance. Okay. Okay. Pressure divided by resistance is equal to flow flow through the systemic circulation, flow through the pulmonary circulation has to be the same. They have to match up. We said that the resistance, okay, the resistance in the pulmonary circulation is a lot less because it's a shorter blood vessel, but in order to make flow the same, what has to happen to pressure? Low pressure, low resistance, you get the same flow. Okay? So the right side of the heart, the right ventricle, doesn't develop nearly the same kind of pressure compared to the left side, and you confirm that to yourself in anatomy lab, because what can you tell me about the wall thickness of the right ventricle? It's thin compared to the left ventricle because it develops less pressure to maintain flow on either side of the heart. All right, so pulmonary blood is pumped at a lower pressure. It's about 15 millimeters of mercury. And what is the pressure in the systemic circulation? This is probably maybe this is even systolic. What's systolic systemic pressure? Systolic. That's when the heart contracts, right? It's 120. 120 over, why are you telling me 80? You're just kidding. Yeah, because I only asked for systolic, right? So 120. All right. So it's about, 10 times less in the pulmonary circulation, right? Because the pulmonary vascular resistance is low because it's a short tube. And that's kind of handy because this lower pressure in pulmonary arteries then forces less fluid out of capillaries. And remember, when fluid gets forced out of capillaries and stays in tissues, we call that edema. That helps reduce pulmonary edema, because if there's water in your lungs, you can't get air in there, right? So that's handy. Now here is something that's a little strange. Pulmonary arterioles constrict where alveolar PO2 is low and dilate where it is high. What kind of control is this? Is this intrinsic control or extrinsic control? Intrinsic or extrinsic? Intrinsic control, it's just a property of the lungs, right? Just a normal property of the lungs, so that's intrinsic control. I think I mentioned it before because I didn't see it in the book. Maybe it's in the book, but it's really important. Can I erase all this stuff right here? Okay. So we're going to look at how many circulations are there? There's two, pulmonary, right, and systemic. So let's talk about systemic first. Systemic circulation. Here is an arteriole bringing blood to a capillary, like so. Then here's the venule coming out. And there are precapillary sphincters right here that are under intrinsic control. They're controlled by the metabolism of what's happening in this tissue. Is that kind of ringing a bell when I said that before? Okay. The diameter of this sphincter is controlled by metabolism, right? And say this is an exercising muscle. What changes in metabolism or metabolites would you expect? If this is an exercising muscle, what about ATP? If it's an exercising muscle, it's going to go down. All right, so now we got lower ATP around these cells. Sorry, that's a really lousy arrow. If ATP goes down, then the other molecule goes up. What's produced when ATP goes down? Okay, I like lactic acid, but I was thinking of something before that. I was thinking of ADP, right? When you hydrolyze ATP, ADP kind of builds up. All right, when that muscle is exercising, it also produces lactic acid, because when muscle contracts, blood can't get into it. So let's say increase lactate. And so what does that do for pH? Decreases pH. All right. So when this happens, in the systemic circulation, also then what about oxygen? Low oxygen. And what? High CO2. I'm glad, let's put all those in there.
When that muscle is exercising.
So all of these metabolites right here have an effect on the precapillary sphincter. They relax the precapillary sphincter. Right, and so when the precapillary sphincter relaxes, it dilates. What happens to flow through this capillary? Right, if the radius of this vessel increases because the sphincter relaxes, what happens to flow? Yeah, by Poiseuille's law, right? By the fact of radius times radius times radius times radius, the change. All right, so these metabolites will increase blood flow to this particular capillary bed. And it's not just these metabolites, but the change in them as well, right?
All right, so low oxygen causes, let's put it over here, causes what? Dilation. And that's just intrinsic control. In what kind of circulation? Systemic circulation. So here's a nice exercising muscle. What's another circulation? Pulmonary circulation. There is local control. There is intrinsic regulation. So here is a pulmonary artery coming in. Here's a capillary. Right. Here is a nice, and this is around an alveolus. So here's, and what we got inside this alveolus? Air. We got air in this alveolus, and here is a vein coming out. Okay, here's something strange. Over here, what did decreasing oxygen do to this sphincter? It caused dilation. Over here in the pulmonary circulation, if there is decreased oxygen here, that causes constriction. Of this precapillary sphincter.
Okay, and maybe some other things. Maybe increased CO2.
Sorry, the other way, decreased CO2.
But we can just focus on oxygen. Do you see that it's opposite?
Decreased oxygen causes constriction here. Decreased oxygen over here causes dilation. So that's pretty important, right? That's important because when oxygen decreases, it's the job of the circulatory system to bring oxygen to this area so that it can maintain its metabolism. Now, what about the pulmonary circulation? Decreased oxygen causes constriction, the opposite thing in terms of local control, and does that make sense? So here's the sense that it makes. When there is low oxygen in this alveolus, there is no reason, no good reason why this blood should go to this alveolus, because why is the blood going to the lungs? To pick up oxygen. And if there's no oxygen right here, then there's no reason why blood should go to this alveolus. It will want to do what? It's going to want to go to another alveolus that is high in oxygen. Okay. And this high oxygen is going to cause dilation of that sphincter. That's local control. That's really powerful. Okay. And so that helps match ventilation. It helps match what kind of gas is in the alveolus with how much blood goes through there. We call that perfusion. It helps match perfusion to ventilation, the reverse. So if you want to think of the pulmonary circulation and the systemic circulation, one thing that's really nice, helpful for me, is that they're what? In a lot of ways, they are opposite each other. Okay? So the pulmonary artery is low in oxygen. A systemic artery is high in oxygen. So a lot of things are exactly opposite.
All right, so this is pretty strange. And that kind of tells you why sleep apnea is so dangerous. What is sleep apnea all about? Yeah, so you fall asleep, you stop breathing, right? And then you kind of wake up and, right, then you're out of breath, and that might happen all night long, or maybe you don't quite wake up, but you almost wake up. So what happens?
So when you're not breathing, what happens to oxygen in this alveolus? It goes down, right? When you have sleep apnea, it goes way down, which then causes what to this precapillary sphincter? Okay? It causes it to constrict, okay? That increases the resistance when it constricts. What about pressure? What happens to pressure then?
What's pressure equal to? Thank you. The key term right here is resistance.
Right? So when somebody's not breathing during sleep apnea, oxygen is down, increases resistance, right? And if the flow has to be maintained, what happens to pressure in the pulmonary circulation? If the resistance increases, right, that's going to increase the pressure. So sleep apnea causes pulmonary hypertension, right? Systemic hypertension? Is it something that you should be concerned about, or can you live with it and not worry about it? Hypertension, serious disease, because it's going to kill every organ in your body, like kidneys and the heart, the hypertension, systemic hypertension. Well, same kind of bad things happen for the pulmonary circulation when the pulmonary pressure increases, right, when somebody has sleep apnea. Sleep apnea produces all kinds of weird kinds of symptoms, and this is why somebody can get pulmonary hypertension, right? They can, and that means that the right side of the heart has to work a lot harder, and so they can have right side heart failure instead of left side as a result of sleep apnea. So sleep apnea is a pretty serious condition. If you know somebody with it, they probably need to have it diagnosed and corrected if possible, right? Because it can kill the right side of their heart, not the left side. And it's hard to know what's happening on the right side of your heart, right? Okay. All right, so next time we're going to finish up pulmonary. And sign-in sheet is going around. Yeah, we can finish it up next time. Oh, what kind of control is this called? What kind of control? It doesn't have anything to do with the nervous system. It's called intrinsic, and another way of thinking about it, local control. Thank you. Local. Due to the metabolism or metabolites in the area of that capillary.